Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Uli Korch. He is the founder of both the Monetary Trust Initiative and Global Partners Investments. He has worked in over 50 countries, written a bill for Congress, and conferred with approximately 15 national presidents, ministers of finance, and ministers of commerce. Welcome, Uli.
Thank you, Richard. Great talk to you, Greg.
Great. Yeah, I thought today we'd do a focus on the Monetary Trust Initiative. You founded that and spoken about it some in the past on our prior podcasts, and just wondering if we can look at that today, where it stands, what the current status is, next steps, and why it makes sense to do.
All righty, sure, I appreciate that. That's kind of where my heart is at, and most of the time my brain too.
Okay, yeah.
The issue that we're trying to deal with, let's talk about the name first of all. So it's a monetary trust. It's not in the sense of banking, although we deal with the monetary and banking system. It is to trust our monetary system, to trust our money. Let me start with some basics. I tend to spend 80% of my time explaining how the current system works, and only 20% of the time explaining what it is that we're trying to do. Because if people do not understand how the current system works, then the solutions or the changes that we are advocating make absolutely no sense whatsoever. It's like trying to come up with a solution for cancer when you're convinced all you have is a scratch in your arm.
Right.
Or your brain, or your whatever. And you're going, well, actually, no, that's not a scratch. That's an underlying tumor that has broken through the skin. And you go, what? Yeah, so we need to forget about the scratch in the arm. So this is kind of the same issue. So let me deal with some fundamentals, first of all, which tend to blow most people's minds. Let's talk about how our money is created. And I've talked to PhDs, I've talked to all sorts of people. I ask them, my standard question is, to the dollar that's in your pocket, how was it created? And the standard answer almost every time is, well, I earned it. That's not the question. The question is, how was it ever formed? Where did it come from? I hope you did earn it and you didn't steal it. And almost everybody thinks that it's the Fed that creates our money, but it's not. It's the commercial, the normal private bank, commercial simply means private in this context, around the corner from which you borrow money. Almost everybody thinks that that money came from a prior saver. It didn't. Let me walk through the saving intermediation process. So let's say that you want to buy a Ford. And so you walk in and the banker goes, oh, Mr. Benulli, yeah, you're a good guy, Richard. You know, I like you. You've dealt with us for, a lot of years. How much money do you need? He said, well, I need $30,000 to buy this Ford. Okay, fine. Absolutely, no problem. So if you could sign this contract here, please, then we will lend you the $30,000. And so when you sign the contract, that's an asset to the bank. And let's assume that we now do an intermediation process. And so the bank takes $30,000 from a prior saver and moves it into your account. It doesn't happen, but I'm just saying that's what most people think.
Okay? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So where did that $30,000 came from? Well, it came from a man who saved the money. Well, who was that man? He happened to be working for Ford. What a coincidence. And Ford paid the money to the employee who saved the $30,000, which you now have. What do you do? Well, you go to your dealer and you give the dealer the $30,000 so that you can get the car, plus some extra, obviously. And the dealer then turns around and gives that $30,000 to Ford, which gives the $30,000 to the worker, which gives the $30,000 to the bank, which gives the $30,000 to you, which gives, this is one big circle.
Yeah.
The money hasn't come from anywhere. And people don't think about this. And you say, okay, well, we are not intermediating money from previous savers because the previous saver didn't exist. Because where did the saver get the money from? Well, the same place you did. You got it from the bank. Well, no, no, no. You earned it. Well, no, no, no. Where did the money come from? So, okay, that's step number one. Step number two, then most people think, well, the money actually came from the Fed. You know, the Fed over a period of a year and a half after the 2007-2008 crisis printed approximately $3 trillion worth of money. And we run a fractional reserve banking system. Well, no, those are reserves. And reserves never hit the street. None of us have gotten a penny of those. I had a public discourse with a member of the Fed here on that. And he came up to me afterwards because, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, the reserves do not ever hit the street. They create massive inequality. That's a different subject. So where does the money come from? The money comes from the fact, let's go back to you want to buy your Ford. And so you sign the contract for the $30,000. And the bank, out of nothing, creates that $30,000 deposit. And I have bankers arguing against me, saying that's not true, that's not true. That is true in the aggregate, in the overall system, the way it works. Okay. Yeah. In the bank's bookkeeping, it looks different. But that's, in effect, what happens. Let's reverse the whole process. And let's keep the numbers simple. Let's say that even though you're an excellent credit, you have an excellent credit rating and all that kind of stuff, let's say that the bank charged you 10% interest. Whatever, it's just a nice round number. And so you have a really good year, Richard, and at the end, then you haven't made any payments. At the end of the year, you go to the bank manager and you say, look, I want to pay my whole loan off. I've had a really good year. And of course, you owe the $30,000 principal plus a $3,000 in interest. That's a total of $33,000. So you hand the bank a check or cash or whatever. It's not going to be cash, but $33,000. And you give the bank the $33,000. What happens with that money? Well, the $3,000 is income to the bank from the money that it created out of nothing. Mm-hmm. The $30,000 that you have now paid off, it started off as nothing. It ends up as nothing. The bank, in its bookkeeping, in the aggregate, destroys that $30,000. It did not exist to begin with. It does not exist at the end.
Okay.
So we've got several things here that are now obvious if you start thinking through it. Number one, basically, I'm using the word basically, there's some minor exceptions, but 100% of our money is created through debt. It's what we call bank money versus cash, okay? And almost everything today is bank money. There's relatively little, very little cash out there. I had an argument with a member of the IMF as to whether it's 1% or 3%. I said 3%. He says, no, 1%. Other people say 11%. It depends on what you are calling as aggregate. So forget the percentage. It's very small.
Yeah.
Basically, all of our money is created through debt. So there are implications to that. Number one, we must have an ever-increasing level of debt in order to have price stability. If you think that we have a growing GDP, okay, gross domestic product, then in order to have price stability, if GDP grows by 2%, then the monetary aggregates have to grow by 2%. Let me just go back to that word, monetary aggregate. That's a big $63 word for a meaning all the money that's in circulation of whatever type, mm-hmm. cash, bank money, you name it. Okay, all the stuff that's out there in circulation that we tend to call money. We have to have an ever-increasing level of debt, but a lot of economists say, well, the debt doesn't matter because it's one person's debt and it's another person's asset. No, this did not come from previous savers. Debt creates saving, not saving creates debt. You've got to turn the whole thing on its head.
Okay. Yeah.
If there was no debt, there would be no savings. It's not most people think, well, if there was no savings, there'd be no debt. No, it's the other way around. Mm-hmm. That's a mind blower for almost everybody.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We're really getting into the weeds here. Next, let's the collapse of societies of economies over the last 100 years, and read Kindleberger, you know, et cetera. This time it's different. The classical book on the study of debt bubbles. This is why we collapse. We always overshoot. Let me ask you another question, for instance. Let's go back to your car. You now get to the end of the year, and you're paying your $33,000 back. We know that the $30,000 was created by the bank. I have a question for you. Where did the $3,000 come from?
I guess I had to come up with it, right?
You see, yeah. We are always short.
Yeah.
We're always short. There is never enough. Because we only create debt. We do not create interest.
Yeah.
We're always short. Okay. Let's talk about inequality, which is another example of this. The first users of the money are always the greatest beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, that's the banks or the people wealthy enough to be able to borrow these funds at, especially over the last decade, at ridiculously low interest rates.
Yes.
I remember speaking on this on a conference in Dallas, and I had and I was challenging the ethics of this, not the ethics individually, but the ethics corporately or socially. Mm-hmm. I had someone come up to me at the end, not that old guy, you know, a lot younger than me, that's for sure. And he says, "Uli, the guy that you describe, that's me.
Okay.
I have an unlimited credit line with the bank for 1.7% interest at 6-to-1 for my assets. There are no limits." He says, "What do I do?"
Yeah.
I said, "Well, go out and make a lot of money and give it away. give it to charity or whatever. If you feel bad about it, but that's the system."
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, who's the beneficiary? It's not me who's the second or third or whatever on the level of the money creation, but it's him because he has the immediate money creation. He gets the first dibs, the best deals, the best capacity to what he will get richer.
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay. Back to reserves, which I mentioned earlier. Which is the $3 trillion in reserves roughly that the Fed created and that the European Central Bank, the ECB, is still creating, and the JGB, the Japan Central Bank, is still creating on a massive level. By the way, the aggregate of those two is greater than the amounts that we were creating in the heyday of the quantitative easing program that was here in the U.S.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's talk about those reserves. It's a dual cycle system whereby you have two cycles that run simultaneously that do not interact. So when the Fed creates $3 trillion, we run a fractional reserve banking system at about a 10% reserve ratio, which means in theory, if it's the Fed that was creating the money through their reserve system, then $3 trillion would be the equivalent of $30 trillion on the street. Because remember, it's 10% reserve, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that hasn't happened. At least I didn't get any of that money. Did you, Richard? Did you see any of that $30
trillion? No.
No. You didn't either. Exactly. So how does this work? Well, what happens is in the FOMC, in the open market operations of the Federal Reserve Bank, what happens is they create this money. I hate to even call it money because it's reserves. They create something on their balance sheet, and they go out and buy paper, treasuries, and also agencies here in the U.S. I don't know what the audience is primarily that we're talking. Agencies are basically pseudo-government guaranteed housing papers. I say pseudo because it's an implied guarantee. It's not an actual direct guarantee.
Right.
But the government has picked those up consistently whenever there's a problem. But it is not specifically guaranteed. Nonetheless, it's close enough. So the Fed purchases treasuries and agency debt.
Yes.
And with a variety of term lengths, depending on what it is that they want to do. All right, but let's walk through this. So the Fed creates $1,000 because, you know, bonds are always nominally $1,000. That doesn't mean that they're trading it, but nominally $1,000. And goes to a bank and say, "Dear Mr. Bank, we would like to buy one of the treasuries that the bank has bought." The Fed, by the way, it's illegal for them to operate on the primary market. The Fed cannot buy these from Treasury. They have to buy them from a bank, okay, or from a primary dealer, which is a bank. So then the bank hands over the treasury for $1,000. Where does that $1,000 go? It goes nowhere. It is an accounting entry that goes from an asset to the Fed to an asset to the bank. But it stays as a reserve. It never, ever hits the street. Okay. However, the effect of on inequality is unbelievable. So assets, remember, we're buying two kinds of assets now, treasuries and agencies. Agencies are houses,
yeah,
and treasuries are bonds. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what we've done is we've forced the whole market into greater risk, and the people who have owned those assets, they've gone through the roof. Who are those people? Those are the wealthy people. So the top 1%, the top 1/10 of 1% is the almost exclusive beneficiary of these trillions of dollars that have been created. And again, I had an argument with this way back when this whole process started, and in public with a member of the Federal Reserve Bank. And I said, you are the ones causing the greatest degree of inequality. Like, he's a hot and hot. Later on, I wanted to see him afterwards, after the speech was over. And he said to me, "Oli, you're actually right." And I said, well, why didn't you say it publicly? You know, they want to own it. They don't want to own up to that publicly. The banking system favors assets. It does not favor labor.
Yes.
And it preserves them and it increases their value. And those people who earn their money through their own labor do not benefit from this. And the way to solve this is not through redistributionism or taxing the rich. As far as I'm concerned, all it's a bunch of malarkey. The way to solve this, and that's the purpose of the Monetary Trust Initiative, is to change our whole system, how this works.
Yeah, these are very, very important points you're making, Uli. It's too often today, a lot of people do not understand that. They don't see that, and they're incorrectly assigning blame to other aspects of our economic system. And it's a shame because, with a deep understanding of this, not only do you understand what has happened, why it has happened, the financial crisis, but as you mentioned, this, you know, leads to a solution. You know, how can we address these challenges?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let me give a plug for my videos just for a second. So I was asked to run a conference on this before we actually understood a whole lot more. I use the hopefully it's not the royal we, but there are more and more people. There's a ground swelling of understanding of the system and the problems within the system that's happened over the last few years. Mm-hmm. So this was 4 years ago. I ran the conference at the Fed, and I knew that, you know, I mean, all the video, I wanted to make sure everything was live and was recorded. It was, first of all, it was presented live and people around the world watched it. And also all the videos are still available. They're all archived, but I knew, you know, nobody's going to watch hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of people giving talks. So I created a 40-minute summary, which is on my YouTube channel. So that's youtube.com/ucort, UKORTSCH. I can't spell my own name. UKORTSCH.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's a second video from the bottom. The last one is my own talk. I was a wrap up speaker at the Fed dealing on social issues. But the next one up, the second oldest video, that is the 40-minute overview of the whole day at the Fed. There is a lot, and this was not pre-planned in advance among the speakers, but you'll see the same theme comes over and over, which is, you know, basically what we're talking about here. So.
Okay, we'll make that clear and available as a link on the write-up of this discussion to our listeners.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Back to the Monetary Trust Initiative. So then looking at these issues, and there are more, but these are the biggest issues. Mm-hmm. What do we do about it? And the question really comes down to money creation. That is the fundamental issue. We can get into arguments with the Austrians, for the not people from Austria, but Austrian economists, which is what they tend to be called, about gold standards or methods of limiting the amount of money production. Mm-hmm. In my mind, that's secondary. I just had a good telephone call with a friend of mine who's a strong Austrian who teaches in their on the Mises School and all of that stuff, and has spoken to the European Parliament. Where in my mind, there are two separate issues. Number one is how money is created. And that, in my mind, is fundamental. And then number two is how do we control that? And I don't want to say one is more important than the other, but you cannot have the second issue without solving the first issue. And the first issue, how money is created, we have to take it out of the hands of the private banks. This is a ridiculous and extraordinary privilege that they have, where they have a privilege on two levels. Number one, they're allowed to create money. And number two, they're allowed to merge their funds with their customers' funds. Nobody else is allowed to do that. That is illegal everywhere else. You go to a mutual fund, you go to any of the shadow banking systems, you go to any investment fund, and the owners cannot mix their own funds with our clients. It's illegal. But banks are allowed to do that. And this is why we have bank runs and the financial instability, which comes, I mean, there's so many repercussions to our monetary system. It's just crazy. Mm-hmm. So how do we then create the money? Well, there are actually some minor examples historically and still ongoing as to where this is done. And this is through sovereign money, where it's the power of the state to create money. You go, whoa, you're just printing money. No. What we're doing is the control level is actually much better, because currently all the money printing, it's not like we're not printing money. Of course we're printing money. We have to print money all the time in order to have price stability if we have a growing economy, right? I know I'm repeating, just in case people lost that part. Mm-hmm. But bankers, they want to maximize their loans. The only reason they do not issue loans is because they don't trust the customer or the economy. They think the economy is about to tank. Man, I'm not going to do any more loans. Mm. And so you have these huge ups and downs in business cycle. That's another result of this kind of system. Okay. So if you get away from banks creating money, you stabilize the system. And how do you distribute it? Well, there's a number of different suggestions as to how to do that. That was an incoming phone call. One of which is directly through the government. And in the U.S. and Canada, you could say a certain portion, let's say, somewhere between 60 to 80% goes to the federal government, and somewhere between 20 to 40% goes to the provinces or the states to also help with their budgets. The simple reason is that, at least in theory, the government represents everybody. And so if you want to equally hand the money to everybody, you do it through the government. There's a paper just out by the Swiss National Bank, for instance, and also Michael Kumoff of the Bank of England suggests instead that at least a certain portion, or I think the paper from the Swiss National Bank says all of that money, is handed directly to the individuals. Then the question is, to whom? Only to citizens? To what ages? To et cetera, et cetera. I mean, my suggestion is just do it through the government. Everybody gains, taxes are lowered, services are improved, and everybody ends up gaining that way. Then banks become true intermediaries. Just like an investment fund is today, an investment fund doesn't have any money unless somebody puts the money in. Well, it's the same with a bank. So the bank gets depositors, and those depositors are people who are secondarily, tertiarily, whatever, receiving money from the government. Not checks from the government, but direct services and indirect you know, multiple generations down for what ends up happening. And it creates stability in the system because when you have a decreasing economic situation, as we do to date, the government can actually increase the amount of distribution and pull back later on. There are ways of doing it. That would get too technical for this discussion here, I think. I think we'd really lose people in the weeds as to how to do that. Methods that are available, that are in use today. Sterilization, which is a $63 word for sucking money out of the economy.
Okay, yeah. And, I mean, did some of this happen, like, in the U.S.-American Revolutionary War back in the 1860s?
Yes, it certainly did. And I'm walking in my office, and just as you mentioned that, I pull out an envelope, and here I happen to have one of these. So they were called U.S. notes, also called greenbacks, where President Lincoln realized that there was no way they're going to be able to pay for the Civil War. And so what they did is they directly created funds on a non-debt basis and used that to pay for the Civil War and to rebuild the country afterwards, rebuild the infrastructure. The equivalent of what they created that way, remember, no debt in today's economy in the U.S. would be about $5 trillion. And the definitive book written on that era by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, they spend about 20 pages explaining why there was a strong inflationary period during that time. And people saying, yeah, it's because of the greenbacks. No, it wasn't. They spent 20 pages of their book saying this had nothing to do with the use of greenbacks. What it was the terms of trade with England, which are all gold-based. Uh-huh. And that's what caused the problem. So it was interesting. He said, no, it's got nothing to do with the greenbacks. And by the way, 274 million of them are still in circulation, including my little $5 note that I'm holding in my hand right now as we are speaking.
Okay.
You can tell the difference. And I keep on, every time I talk on this, everybody stops and pulls their wallet out. Federal Reserve notes, which is what we are used to, all have green numbers. And U.S. notes, which is what I'm talking about, have red numbers. Some of them also have red stamps, like the one I have happens to have a red stamp, but that's not necessarily the case. So if you ever see one with a red number, and like I say, there are 274 million of them floating around, do not spend it, because if you go to your bank or your store, they'll only give you what it says on the front. If it's a $1 note, they'll only give you $1, but it's worth a lot more than that. Because today they're collector items, and people are not spending them out, which kind of makes sense to me. I'm doing the same thing. I'm holding on to mine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we could do the same today for infrastructure. You know, President Trump is calling for a $1 trillion infrastructure buildup. We can do the same thing and not create any inflation. It has to be done carefully. I've put a paper together on how to do that in such a way that doesn't create any inflation. And if it does, you can stop it, or you can sterilize the funds, and you would not have any inflation, and we would not be left indebted, especially for projects where the private market, the PPP, private-public partnerships, do not work. There are quite a number of infrastructure aspects where private partnerships really don't work because the source of revenue is highly speculative or not available, so it's simply not there. Versus roads that you can collect tolls on, it makes some sense there.
And so what are the challenges, of bringing this about? Are there any bottlenecks? How can this be done today? What could be the next steps?
The bottlenecks are not the smaller banks. In fact, somebody I'm working closely with is the chairman of the bank, and he is totally in favor. And he says, Ole, bring it on. We got to do this. We've got to do this because the current system is killing the small banks. Since Dodd-Frank, for instance, was enacted, which is the American way of trying to control the banking system after the 2007-2008 crash, about 2,000 community banks have gone bust or have been forced to merge because the regulatory expenses are so burdensome that they can't handle them. Back to the he told me I can use this is Bill Diefenberg, he was runner up to become president of the Federal Reserve here. He's the chairman of a bank, and he says, Uli, we have a board meeting once a month, and he says we spend 99% of our time with the board meeting dealing with the regulatory issues, and 1% of the time trying to run a business. I said, Dunk, can I quote you on that? He says, you bet. He says, I'm just so furious at the system.
Wow.
It's just killing the small banks.
Yeah.
That would not be the case. Dodd-Frank is not needed under a system of sovereign money. Not needed. So who is opposing it? Lawyers, regulatory agencies. There are over 100 regulatory agencies in the U.S. government, and a lot of the employees would lose their jobs because under a sovereign money system or Chicago plan, with the very slight variations in all of these, you do not need the regulatory oversight that we have right now because the system is internally stable. You're still going to need some oversight, fraud, but they could all be handled by the SEC. You would not need the numerous agencies. So that's number one. They'll be opposed because they all lose their jobs. Number two, the lawyers inside the banks, and the large banks disproportionately gain. For instance, Jamie Dimon, the J.P. Morgan Chase, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, loves Dodd-Frank for the simple reason it gives them a huge competitive advantage to all the other banks because they're the largest bank in the U.S., and so they have the wherewithal easily to handle the regulatory morass that has been created and all the funds, all the costs that are associated with that, whereas the other banks can't. So the big get bigger.
Basically, regulatory capture.
Absolutely. Yeah. So he came out publicly and says, I'm all in favor. This is wonderful. Wonderful legislation. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it makes sense for the, bringing the power previously held by the banks back to the people, more of a democratic society, strengthening, democratic process, if you will. Also just general overall better accountability and transparency. Would you not say so?
Absolutely. What's interesting is politically, I find the people that are fairly strongly on the left and the people that are fairly strongly on the right, both of them are in favor of this. It's the people in the middle that sort of aren't affected a whole lot, that don't care that much socially. Those are the biggest ones I have to persuade. The far right, I say, look, this is free enterprise. You can now operate. They go, oh, man, yeah, turn on. The far left, I say, we're going to get rid of inequality. They go, yeah, bring it on. And the people in the middle, the people in the middle go, hey, I want my ice cream and my beer, you know?
Right. Okay, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's funny. Oh, man. And sad. There are some... there's a strong movement internationally, and I don't want to get into that now. I in a few months, I'd be willing to say some more things on that. There's some real movement. There are conferences. I'm just working on another one that I've been asked to do. There are books that are coming out. There's a rising level of interest as people start to understand that in effect, we've been lied to for the last 100 years as to how the system really works. The Bank of England in 2014 put out in one of their standard quarterly issues, put out a paper called, I've got it on my computer, it says something like, modern money creation in the modern economy, something like that. It's quite short. It's only a few pages long. Within those few pages, three times they say, what you are taught in the university as to how we actually create money is not really how it happens. Instead, it's like this, and the way I've just described it to you is the money creation is all by the commercial banks. And the limitation is through their tier one, tier two levels, has nothing to do with the reserves, and their estimation of the credit worthiness of the borrower, which then takes the economy into account also. Mm-hmm. So obviously, back to your car, if you're going to buy your Ford, they assume you're going to keep your job. As to whatever your level of income is now, that's going to be steady over the course of the loan. If they figure the economy is going to crash, then it's not just your personal standing, but they figure, well, this guy might lose his job, you know, what kind of a job he's got, you know, et cetera, even though he's a really good dude and he's always paid his debts. So those issues are there. But there's a growing awareness of the fact that we have not been told the truth as to how this actually works. And people are starting to get angry saying, okay, yeah, what are we going to do about it? And most people don't have answers, but that we do have answers. We do have answers.
Yeah. Now, does the Monetary Trust Initiative have a clear, well-defined path or approach to help bring this about? Like, is there something like a strategy that exists?
Yes. I was at a conference. This is an answer to your question. I was at a conference, I don't know, 2-3 years ago. And I believe it was the head of research at the bank, the St. Louis Fed. The St. Louis Fed is kind of like a research Fed. You know, the banks do different things, the 12 regional portions of the Federal Reserve System here in the United States. And I believe it was the director of research. He was speaking, this is really terrible. I, for the life of me, can't remember what he was speaking about. But in the middle of his talk, he suddenly stopped cold. Total silence.
Okay.
And he looked at all of us and he said, you know, there is a completely different way of running this whole system. And on paper, it looks absolutely fantastic. The problem is there's not a single place in the world where it's actually running right now. That's not totally true, but there's not no significant place where it's running. And I thought, yes. So I went up and talked to him afterwards because I knew immediately what he was talking about. So my goal, or the Monetary Trust Initiative's goal, has been since then, we're going to create a model. So I was hoping to go after Puerto Rico because in my book, so 4 years ago, I predicted that Puerto Rico is going to declare bankruptcy. Well, now they have, you know, sad to say, it just happened. Looking at New Zealand now looking at some other small places, which I don't want to mention right now, but in a few months, I'll be happy to talk about it. Whereby there is a monetary autonomy. In other words, it would be difficult to do it within the Eurozone. And there would have been very special things put into place for Puerto Rico because it operates on the US dollar, which I sort of thought through at that time. But to find a jurisdiction, yeah, whereby we can change the system such that it's a demonstrable model that can be studied, and the pros and cons. I'm sure there's going to be mistakes. I'm sure that there's going to be fallout. There always will be people fighting it too.
Yes.
And so we have to watch out for that also. But nonetheless, to create a jurisdiction where this is operational, and that's all of our attention is going towards that. I mean, I've been asked to write some short papers for the administration, which I've done. And I've been told they want to call me in and talk to me. They have not. So, I'm not pursuing that anymore. I've done my papers.
Okay.
As to the American system, as to what to do here. And I'm just leaving it at that and concentrating on a single jurisdiction.
And is it operational there now?
No, it is not, no.
Okay. I mean, I guess one thing that maybe our listeners might be interested in reading is that paper you refer to on whether this could create inflation and how it could be contained, sterilization. Could that paper be made available to our listeners, readers?
Sure. I've been wanting to start posting papers on my website. That's the ulikorch.com. That's not the case yet. So I hope to do that in the next little while, and then I'll start posting a number of, and they're all short papers. They're Instead of one Mongo thing where I try to tackle the whole thing, what I try to do is deal with one subject at a time, which is easier to digest, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be very interesting.
Obviously, yeah. You know, through your own sources, Richard, you know, I'm happy to let that go out. So there's no price. I'm not trying to hang on to it, you know.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. And just any final words as we wrap up?
Yeah, there's hope. I haven't responded yet. One of the listeners of my last video said, yeah, okay, this is really great, but how in the world do you ever think you can pull this off? I need to get back to them. It's just life is too busy. Yeah, there really is hope, actually, that there's some amazing things happening around the world. There really are. On a very academic level, and starting to influence the central banks, like Michael Kumoff, for instance, at the Bank of England, who has a large voice. There are others. He just happens to be a personal friend and, you know, somebody who's had with his various papers that he's put out on it, has had a real, real push on that. There was a joint conference recently, just at the end of last year, put on by the combination of the banks, the Central Bank of England, Holland, and Iceland. They had a conference at the Central Bank in Holland, and the title of the conference was The Role of Money in the Modern Economy, and they had 30 people that were invited for a roundtable discussion. I was one of 30 people that were invited. I was very honored. And there are people there from around the world who see this and say, what are the options? What are we going to do about it? Because we're heading towards a ravine here, ladies and gentlemen. This train is coming up for a wreck, and we've got to have things in place before that happens.
Wow, words of wisdom. Thank you very much, Willie, for coming on the program show.
Well, thank you, Richard, for the time.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.